Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, and I have a special treat for you today. I'm going to be replaying right here live on the radio and on the internet a recording of a panel discussion that I served on in Boulder, Colorado last week. It was at the 57th Annual Conference on World Affairs, and if you're listening from Boulder, Colorado, I want to thank you very much for having me in your town, a town filled of some really thoughtful people, I think, and I want to thank you for inviting me there, and I hope you'll listen in, even if you attended the conference, and maybe you just missed this panel. It was live before about 1,000 people. It was a very good panel discussion, I think. And that's why I'm replaying it for you today. The panelists were Ellen McGirt, Richard R. Good, Joss Vasconcellos, and myself, Mark Levine. And I'll be playing the panel in just a minute. The first guest to appear on the panel is Ellen McGirt. She is a contributor to Money Magazine. That's one of the main things she does. She writes about health care, personal finance. She's an African-American woman, and yet she's one of those rare African-Americans that actually votes Republican from time to time. And while I can never forgive her for voting for Bob Dole in 1996, she is a wonderful person, and I think you'll enjoy hearing from her. What I'm going to do is introduce each of the panelists here. Unfortunately, the first part of the tape is missing, so that's the introductions. I'll be giving those to you. But otherwise, I won't be interrupting. There will also be no commercial interruptions. It's a special broadcast. You're going to hear the panel live as it happens, with only a short interruption from me to introduce each of the guests. So no commercial interruptions and no call-ins either. If you're listening on the radio, you'll be able to hear all four panelists, including myself. I'm the fourth and final panelist. You'll have to stay tuned for that. And you'll be able to hear some of the questions from the audience. If you're listening on the internet, then you get something really special. You get to hear all of the questions from the audience. I expect the broadcast to go over on the internet approximately 20 to 30 minutes. Again, no call-ins today, at least no call-ins on the radio broadcast. If there's something you really feel you need to say and you want to call in, you can hang on at the very end of the panel discussion on the extended internet broadcast. I can take some of your calls at 877-57-SCOOP. But I suspect there won't be any calls today. If you want to comment, you can write on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com and talk with each other about the panel. So let me start again with Ellen McGirt. She is the first panelist. And unfortunately, as I said, the first part of her remarks are missing. They were very interesting. She talked about why black people sometimes vote against their interest, and she gave an extended discussion on the problem of AIDS in the black community, that because of prejudice against gay people, a lot of gay people who are black go ahead and marry women instead of men, and end up doing things on the down low, as it's said in the black community. And when they do that, obviously there's some shame involved. They're told that being gay is wrong, so they don't protect themselves with safe sex, and then they end up transmitting things like the HIV virus to their wives unknowingly. It's a big problem, and that was her first discussion. You miss pretty much all of that, though, and the discussion begins with the second big point that Ellen McGirt was making, and it's about Social Security. Let me go live to, well, not live, it's a recording, but let me go right now to the Conference on World Affairs. The panel is What's the Matter with Kansas? Voting Against Your Own Best Interests. And here is Ellen McGirt.
From things like HIV/AIDS, which the black churches will continue to not talk about overwhelmingly. The second issue I wanted to talk about, which is the most recent and insidious disinformation campaign to the black community, is the current debate on Social Security. And it annoys me beyond belief that this is even happening. But wherever you are in the Social Security issue, this one part of it is absolutely not true from any way you look at it. It's the notion that Social Security is bad for black people. That because it gets worse, it's that black people will suffer poor or negative rates of return on their investments into the Social Security system because they don't live as long as white people. This is shocking, shocking. White conservative America, everyone from Newt Gingrich to the president, is shocked that we are getting ripped off. Shocked. Now, by the same screwed up logic, all you white women in here are ripping us off because you live longer than anybody. Asians are raking it in. Demographically, Hispanics live forever. This is outrageous. So now comes the campaign. The president, in January, had a closed-door meeting with a series of black ministers across the country to talk about his messed-up math when it comes to this. Closed? Can you imagine what it would be like to be a minister, a black minister in this country and get a closed-door meeting with the president? That's a pretty big deal, I think. And this is what they wanted to talk about, that Social Security privatization is a good deal for all Americans, but for black Americans in particular, because then they're going to get a nest egg that they can turn over to the rest, to their families, because they're not going to make it well much past 65. And they'll be paying into the system for all that time. Now, there has been a little bit of outrage from the NAACP and some black leaders. Julian Bond, who is ever articulate about these things, has weighed in. But I fear that this unbelievably capable and wonderful network is going to go back and they're going to say, we need to really rethink about this issue, or they're going to use it as a bargaining point for something else that they think that they're going to want more, that will be more meaningful for them. And it's not true. Let me just walk you through the numbers so you can brace yourself for your next cocktail party. African Americans and Hispanics, too, make up a disproportionately large segment of workers earning low and moderate wages. Social Security, as it now stands, is a progressive benefit formula that ensures that these workers get a higher return over time. They get 56% of their income back versus 35% for higher wage earners. Automatically, right off the bat, a good deal. Retirees, just looking at the retiree population, Social Security is the dominant source of income for Americans over age 65. 88% of black Americans over age 65 rely on Social Security. Only 19% of that population have income from private pensions, and only 29% have income from other assets. They absolutely need it. The life expectancy thing is complete and utter bullshit. Yes, and please vote for me in November. How sad it is I'm completely unelectable. Just listen to my old conference tapes and you'll know why. From birth, the average black male has a life expectancy of 68 years versus 74 years for white Americans. This is a disparity that is shocking and that is upsetting, and we should talk about what that actually is. But the life expectancy differential closes over time. So by the time a black male turns 18, it's much less. By the time they turn 40, it's much less. By the time they turn 65, it's only about 1.8 years. So what Bush actually did in his meetings and subsequent things, in subsequent press conferences, was add that 2 years to 65 and come up with 67. That's when black people are going to drop dead and they're not getting their money. Not true. If a member of the black community successfully gets into the workforce and begins to have a family and do all the things that people like to do, the chances of them reaping the benefits of their significant investment in Social Security are very, very, very good. Now, the offset is that Social Security comes in three flavors. There's retiree benefits, there's disability benefits, and there's survivor benefits. I would not have been able to go to school, to college, if it wasn't for the survivor benefits I got from my father's Social Security. So I am one black girl to tell you that this story actually works. African-American children represent close to 23% of those who are receiving survivor benefits. 18% of workers are receiving disability care. This protects a family. For example, if someone who is, if a worker dies with children at age 10, leaving a $5,000 private security account, that money's going to run out in probably about 6 months, but if you annuitize it carefully, maybe about a year. Social Security survivor benefits and disability payments are annuities. That kid is going to get on average of $10,000 to $11,000 a year until they turn 18. That's going to be the difference between a family sliding into poverty or not sliding into poverty. So let's talk about why African Americans are disproportionately more likely to end up needing disability benefits. That would be back to the healthcare system again. Why are they disproportionately more likely to need survivor benefits? Now we're going to go back to the healthcare system again. So this is where consistently the black community is failing to see what the emergency is right there in front of them for all kinds of superstitious reasons, which I have a strong opinion about, and also for structural reasons. because it's pretty overwhelming when the leader of the free world calls you in and gives you a sandwich and says, you know what, you guys are getting screwed and I'm going to help you. So I'm going to end my remarks today, my rant today, my screed, with a story that of a man that I met when I was following the Edwards campaign through South Carolina. It was at a church. It was a wonderful black church in Columbia, and I loved going. I loved going to church with these people. These people have real problems. They're up against it in ways that it's easy to forget that people are up against it in America. And I interviewed a man who owns a barber shop. He doesn't have all his teeth, which told me immediately everything I needed to know about his access to health care. And I asked him about AIDS and same-sex marriage and all those other things. And I asked him about abortion. Deeply religious man said to me thoughtfully, you know, for a long time it was illegal for me to be me in this country. For a long time it was illegal for me to travel or marry anybody I wanted. As much as I think that stuff, that gay stuff, that abortion stuff, is wrong, and I wouldn't want anyone in my family to do it, I think it's somebody else's business. Because he remembers how much it meant to him to be treated like a full human being and to not be understood. So, with my slam against the black churches, that is my message of hope, that it's possible through good communication and consistent communication and breaking through the bullshit and looking at the numbers that we can get good people to think more deeply about the complicated issues that are in all our lives. Thank you very much.
The next person that we have is Richard Argood. He is the editorial page editor of the Star Ledger in Newark, New Jersey. He's received the Pulitzer Prize, in fact, for editorial writing, and he's also received a 3-time writing award from the American Society of Newspaper Editors. I present to you Richard Argood.
Well, I'm here to tell you that Ellen is dead right about the power of the black church, and I understand why Mr. Bush is focusing there. If you want to be elected to public office in Philadelphia, the Stations of the Cross are black churches. You go to the massive churches in West and North Philadelphia, and you make your case. And the pastors are incredibly powerful people who bring in national figures and who are virtually unknown to the white community. That's a good indication of just how smart the Republicans were in turning Kansas around. It's part of American history, though. I mean, I just finished Walter Isaacson's Franklin biography. Franklin, when he was a Pennsylvania politician, would occasionally run against the Germans, who were a force because they were the most recent immigrants. They were also the most belligerent immigrants. They wanted to kill all the Indians, and Franklin's people were a bit calmer about it. There were people who voted against their own best interest there. You know, probably it was inevitable that the boys would go after black folks because they have been conning white people in the South since the WOA. The Lost Cause is a total invention aimed at maintaining votes and order. You could have some poor redneck peckerwood like my ancestors. He would be convinced by the political figures that his life may really, really suck, but we, the vested power interests, will guarantee that the black guy has an even worse life. There's a whole discipline in American history, 19th and 20th century American history, the Southern history, which focuses on that remarkable achievement by generations of politicians. First, Democrats, who were perfectly willing to tolerate Southern attitudes in order to keep the coalition together. And then along came George Wallace. Well, Ellen's younger than me. She covered John Edwards. I covered George Wallace. And I'm here to tell you that George Wallace could speak to the gut. He did not speak to the brain. He would talk about bureaucrats who can't park their bicycles straight, making decisions on your behalf. he would talk about all these things, and there was always the subtext of race. Incredibly enough, one of the more gifted and evil American politicians, Richard Nixon, was paying attention to all this. The Southern strategy is a deliberate attempt to have people vote against their own best interests. You look at the statistics, Southern whites are still far below the income levels and the accomplishment levels of other people in other places. They're still voting for the guy who plays the race card. They're still voting for those people. They are voting against their own best interests. This is not a new phenomenon. This is not people in Kansas who have their job at the Hormel plant taken away and are perfectly content with that because, by God, the person who took it away from them can pronounce the name of Jesus in a profoundly significant way. It's not a new phenomenon. It's something that people have to fight against. Emotion is always powerful in politics. People get elected out of emotion. You see, yesterday, the junior senator from Texas pretty much advocated murdering judges because, after all, they're activists. You know, there is no outcry about this. It's like it's 1870 in the South and the Ku Klux Klan is riding through defending the purity of Southern womanhood, you know, and we're all agreeing with them. These people do not get an opposition, you know, and the emotional issues belong to them. I mentioned at a panel yesterday the remarkable way that the Democrats turned a great issue that worked in their favor into something that still haunts them. Equality is a good issue. Everybody wants their society to give kids an even chance. Every poll that's ever been taken, even among stone racists, does agree with that. Education is the key to equality. So far, we're in agreement. What did the Democrats do with that issue that belonged to them? By God, busing. Take my kid from this ghetto that I live in and move it to the other ghetto so your measurements are right. Destroying in a stroke an entire component of Democratic voters for the sake of following the issue right over the edge. I mean, I'm so old, I covered Louise Day Hicks. You know, she was not this raving racist she was painted. She was an unsophisticated woman from South Boston who didn't think the kids of South Boston should be taken to Roxbury where they weren't particularly welcome. That's not a complicated issue to understand. It still haunts us. Every time a Republican gets in trouble, he takes some issue that belongs to the Democrats and carries it to its logical extension, confident that there's some Democrat somewhere who would actually do that. Because they have done it in the past. I mean, I don't think that there was a great threat to the nation of an undersupply of extra large wedding dresses in the last election. But there were people who voted on that issue. I personally don't care who marries who. You know, I've been married 3 times. I mean, and women every time, but you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. The good guys fail in their presentation of ideas, and they fail in the presentation of themselves. I once did a campaign swing with Paul Wellstone and talked to people in the crowds. Paul Wellstone, as you might remember, is probably the farthest left senator we've had in a while. Polling data indicated that if he hadn't been killed in that plane crash, he would have been reelected. And I think I know why. I talked to the people at the rallies. I talked to people who said, I agree with very little of what he stands for, but I can feel his integrity. I know he's a good man. I know he'll do the right thing. That's precious. You know, I mean, his replacement, Norm Coleman, has converted in parties and philosophy and all that sort of thing. I don't know that we have too many figures like Paul Wellstone. I'm not talking about the left thing. I'm talking about the integrity thing. Will you really know that this person will do the right thing? In New Jersey, we had a Republican governor, contrary to the blue state, red state cliche, Tom Kaine, an aristocrat. He couldn't even say New Jersey right. He said New Jersey. You know? But he is the most popular governor in my lifetime because he was a man of integrity. Whatever motives you may ascribe to Bush to have put this man in charge of the 9/11 commission with the Democrat from Indiana, Hamilton, the fact was that it instantaneously had credibility because Tom Kaine was there. Tom Kaine had the same kind of resonance with people that Paul Wellstone did. I don't know what all this has to do with what's the matter with Kansas, but I suspect it has a great deal to do with it. Because we've slipped away, just as we have over history, we've slipped away from focusing on the real issues. And I think the tragic example of the lost cause and the absolutely obscene, ballsy extent to extend that lost cause thinking to the black community is just so unbelievable. I can't believe that we will let it happen again. Thank you.
The next panelist is John Vasconcellos. He served in the California legislature for 38 years.
Well, is this broadcasting all right? Okay. I'm a quick learner. I figured that out. I'll put my hands behind my back. I'm John Vasconcellos, and I come from the West Coast, often termed the Left Coast. This is my first time here. And I came out of curiosity because I heard it was a worthwhile conference, and yesterday I had two panels, one on education that went well, one on politics that devolved, apart from what three of the four of us here and a fourth person said. The questions were from people who are still deeply wounded by the loss of all the efforts here on the campaign last fall. People were really vituperative and distancing, and it didn't go anywhere, so it was kind of a distressing time. It's encouraging to see how many of you turn out for this panel that's just titled about Kansas, what's wrong with Kansas. And let me speak what makes sense to me. What I bring to this is 38 years in the California legislature, in the assembly 30 years, where I chaired the Ways and Means Budget Appropriations Committee 15 years with Willie Brown as my speaker, in the Senate for 6, where I chaired Education 4 and Public Safety 4. And I'm most known for a work around self-esteem that Doonesbury did 3 weeks of satire about me about 15 years ago. That's where I made my name. Along with 38 years in office, the same year I began office, I began doing heavy-duty therapy and had been the first kid, the principal's kid, the Catholic kid, duty-bound, shame-ridden, so much down on myself I'd voted against myself in my first election for class president in the eighth grade and lost by one vote. True story. And then as I was beginning to hold office, my district was, mind you, Silicon Valley, a very vibrant, diverse, but talented people, began in therapy and doing some profound reinvention of who I am. So my political career, I always talked about it publicly along the way, but it's about, you know, natural childbirth and holistic health and about self-esteem and about hospice dying. It's about the human dimensions of public policy. With that, I've been trying to figure out how to make sense of what politics are. If you're here in this workshop, I expect that you were trying to figure out what we do with politics next. And before I retired 4 months ago, November, we have term limits, and so I'm out. My brain trust and I decided to create a legacy project in my name, and we're trying to create a new politics, a whole brand new politics in California as a prototype called the Politics of Trust. And it's based upon not a belief people are evil, ugly, and dangerous, the cynical view of human nature which underlies most politics of both parties for the most part, not entirely, which I think is just simply outmoded and no longer serves us at all well. The simple way I can say, we have in the last 40 years since the 60s, a stunning new economy, entrepreneurship, inventiveness, individuality, dot-coms, with all its bumps and global, it still is a stunning new economy that has many people in its thrall and offers promises that are exaggerated but still worthwhile, especially there's the communications being instantaneous around the world. We have a new demography over the last 40 years. Women as equals, gays out of the closet, old folks out of the nursing homes, every race welcome. Left hands like me allowed to use their left hands and not be scorned like I was in the first grade once upon a time. So we have a new economy and a new demography. We have a new consciousness on the parts of many of us, beginning in the baths of Esalen in California and spreading around the world, of spirituality and sexuality and self-esteem and embodiment and whole personhood and collaboration, and how we form relationships that truly serve each and both of us and all of us. One of my mentors, a woman named Judith Brown, a Gestalt therapist in Santa Barbara, pointed out to me that the same rules apply in all relationships. They're either open and trusting and elaborative and disarming, or they're distant and separate. Yet the person next door to us in bed, whoever he or she may be, or the enemy farthest across the world, the same rules apply. We're human beings, the same systems we bring to the table of love, of hate, politics, of war, business, all the rest. Women's movement taught us that the personal and political are one and the same. The lesson we ought to remind ourselves of, it's very, very true. A friend of mine said, the politics we do is who we are. And so we've got this new economy, this new demography, this new consciousness, and yet we have the same old politics. Cynical, divisive, hateful, discouraging, hierarchical, I got mine, screw you, by and large. And it mirrors that old vision of human nature, which I no longer am willing to live by. If you read Paul Ray's book, The Cultural Creatives, he proposes that in America, a quarter of the people, adults, in California, he says, a third have moved into a new culture of feminism, environmentalism, self-esteem, multiculturalism, collaboration, the human dimensions of being human rather than simply the old cynical ways of looking at people. So we're trying to create a politics based upon a faithful vision of human nature. And I'd have to talk about that later, but that's not this topic. Kansas. I read the Kansas book. A friend of mine gave it to me a month ago, and so I brought it with me, and I read three quarters of it. What I learned and hadn't thought about before is just how profoundly not just people vote against their own self-interest. That I've done in my own life enough to have a sense that that's really bizarre and has to be addressed in my own life to make sense of who I am. But more significantly for me, in this, what I learned in this three quarters of the book I read, was how the economic, which has been so basic in our sense of who we are and our wants and needs, has been discarded in favor of these various array of values, whether it's gay rights or gay marriage or abortion or affirmative action. But, you know, I was thinking singularly along the lines that politics is largely informed by the two basic human needs each of us carries. The great need for security. We aren't secure, we're not going to be here. That's the first one. And the great desire for freedom, liberty, self-actualization. And they co-inhere, and they are both our birthrights, it seems to me. So my critique was, we've got all this liberation movement, therapeutic movement, personal growth, encounter, drugs, and music, and all kinds of exploring consciousness and bodies and all the rest, which I think is into a new culture that's much more liberated, if at times libertine, much more individualistic, though at times besought by individualism, where everybody literally is welcome at the table, which is a far cry from the culture in which I was not raised, but lowered the first 35 years of my life. Sits down, shut up, sit still, take orders. The parents, the principal, the priest, the pope, the president. I was their best behaved Catholic subject for 34 years of my life, no more. So there is in America this profound shift or cultural split, because in the 60s we had an affluent society, economic security, and we had a fairly peaceful world, and liberation broke out of all kinds and shapes and colors and forms and behaviors. 9/11 hit, and our security was profoundly subverted, and people hunkered down and said, freedom be damned. So it's like The more secure we are, the more we want freedom. Less secure, the more freedom be damned. And our challenge, in my mind, is how to get our security back on track within ourselves, between ourselves, without thinking that armaments get us that, because they don't. It's a stupid way, it's a macho way, it's an old-fashioned male way that only gets us more armaments and more trouble, and we go, it's a spiral that goes down. The book, though, goes a further step that I'm thinking out loud. I don't know what it means, or I don't know how to point it out, and that is, how come the security, the economics, which have been so crucial to people's lives, identity, and so crucial to democratic successes through the 30s and onward, the middle classes, the lower classes, the working people, the labor unions, how come something has trumped security? Freedom be damned, security be damned, and these values are somehow ascendant and mobilizing. And I think that what's just been said by two of the three people, the two people who spoke, is that emotions run the show, and analysis is fine, but if it's not emotion-based, it's useless. And there's my favorite epistemologist, his name is Jose Vasconcelos, no relation, I'm Portuguese, he was Spanish, revolutionary, founded public schools in Mexico as a president, whose epistemology was the intellect, the senses gather data, the intellect puts it in categories, and the emotions drive our lives based upon those categories. So we got to know who we are in the first place and create a new politics that is all welcoming, so one's a new model of human nature and potential that are truly about realization, inclusion, dignity, and respect, including those who are the least like us and the least part of our particular realm. So the book adds a dimension of, I think what it is so far is that these values are so wedded to their identity that they become more important even than their security. And whether we can find ways to encourage other discoveries of identity, in my case it was through therapy to find my identity myself. When 9/11 hit, I don't feel any less secure. I was appalled by it, it's awful, it's problematic, but my security wasn't rattled by 9/11. How do we deal with the issues of identity and freedom and security in some holistic way that enables us to imagine a politics that is welcoming to everybody, in which they can see their own best interests? Because each of us always acts out of our own best interests as best we know them. And what differs us is how enlightened is our particular self-interest. So to begin psychologically, to me, is the root of a pathway into unwinding the Kansas dilemma. I haven't finished the book, so I don't know whether he got there or not. But it is for me a way to wonder about how we can recognize that politics is in a state of tremendous disrepair. The nation is profoundly divided. It cannot last long that way. And there's been so much going on now in politics about who beats whom, not about what problems get solved. Headlines are about who screams the loudest, not who helps the most people get education or health care or opportunity or whatever else. Press is to blame, partly. Politicians are to blame. The money in politics is awful. The whole thing is on the verge of a collapse, I suspect. I'm not a pessimist. Far from it. But it's going to require a really deep-seated, thoughtful, smart, personally engaged vision of how each of us becomes a politician who can find allies and welcome strangers and somehow together design a system of politics beyond left and right. As Petra Kelly once said when she was asked about the Greens Party in Germany, left or right said, no, we're out front. How to be out front with a vision of politics, a vision of ourselves, our own goodness that includes everybody's goodness, that's healing, that's organizing, that's unifying. I think we have a handle on it. I welcome you to check us out on the website, and if you like it, resonates, help us figure out how we bring it to the fore. But the main point I want to make is that whatever happens in Kansas, what happens in Colorado and East Coast and this country and the world depends upon who you choose to be and how much you recognize that you are a politician and how much you're willing to put your head and your heart and your body on the line in these truly challenging, critical, provocative times.
And I, of course, was the last speaker.
You know, we're sitting here, the four of us, on a panel in Boulder, Colorado. All four of us, I think it's safe to say, are blue state people, blue state voters, and we're asking, what's wrong with Kansas? Why are they voting against their interests? And part of me wonders if in Colorado Springs there's another panel. And they're asking, what's the matter with Massachusetts? Think about it. I want to be on that panel, actually. I want to be confronted by that hostile audience. I'll tell you, part of what I do on talk radio and television is I confront people I disagree with every day. It's gotten so it doesn't faze me at all to be called all kinds of names. But one of the things that I've noticed, it's very interesting, and I also do debates all the time in Washington, D.C. There's a wonderful program, a foundation, that brings high school students from all across the nation. And I debate usually an administration official, and we go out on all kinds of topics. And it's very interesting, particularly after the debate, when I'm talking with the kids from Kansas or from Nebraska. And I have listeners in Kansas, I'm proud to say. My show is streamed on the Internet, so you can hear me wherever. And what's interesting is that they'll come up to me after the speech and they'll say, wow, you know, I think you're right on the environment. And, you know, Mark, you're right on Social Security, and the Democrats, they're right on health care. And actually, you made a good point about taxes, the fact that, hey, we young people have to pay it all back anyway. And I said, great, so you're going to vote for Democrats? They say, no, I have to vote for Republicans. Why? Well, I'm pro-life. I'm pro-life on abortion. Even though I agree with you on every other issue, Mark, I'm a fundamentalist, born-again Christian, and I have to vote that way, but you really made me think about these other issues, thank you very much. And I'm like, wait. We really need to talk about religion in this country. And because people are, I agree with all the panelists, they're most of the time not voting with their minds, but with their hearts. They're voting with their emotions. They're voting with their culture. And if you want to know why Kansas is voting against its interests, you got to talk about born-again fundamentalist Christianity. There's just no way about it. That's why Kansas is voting against its interests. And one of the interesting things about politics is you can care about a single issue so strongly that it trumps everything else. Very interesting. Actually, my former boss, Congressman Barney Frank in Massachusetts, taught me this well. He said, why is it that despite the fact that 70 to 80% of Americans support some form of gun control, not confiscating guns, but basically registering them, just like we register cars, and some would argue that guns have a, you know, the cars have a purpose other than killing people. Some say that, and guns maybe not. But 70-80% of Americans are for gun control. Why is it that consistently we have things like cop killer bullets and armor-piercing stuff? And well, the reason is this. The 20% that love their guns really love their guns. And they love their guns more than those of us who think, well, we could just register them. Feel that they should just register them. You can feel about an issue so strongly that it trumps all the other issues. And I want you to think about this. We say, why do Kansas voters vote against their interests? Well, let's talk about three very famous people, Franklin Roosevelt, Jack Kennedy, John Kerry. Three very wealthy men. Didn't they support things against their interests? After all, if the Republicans are in power, who gets the biggest tax cut of all? John Kerry. And yet he went against his interests. Why? Because he strongly believes in things like social justice. And you don't have to think he was a good candidate to understand that he really believes this stuff and is voting against his interests. And some very wealthy Democrats, George Soros, don't you think he's voting against his interests? So I think sometimes when we pose the question, why is Kansas voting against their interests, there's a little bit of condescension. We vote against our interests all the time. If we believe in social justice or we believe in civil rights for all, that may trump a tax cut, even if we have lots of money. And in Kansas, belief that the Bible is literally true might trump the fact that they're living in dire poverty without health care or your Social Security is running out. And that's a fact. It's not a pleasant fact, but, I mean, it's something I think we need to think about. That's why Kansas is voting against its interests. And one of the things I try to do on my radio show, and I'm very proud of the fact that it does bring in people of differing views, is to discuss these things. And I found, because I really strive to make this a national show, I've been talking a lot about religion lately. A lot about religion. Now, I am a firm believer in the separation of church and state. You won't find anyone that has a stronger belief on that than I. In fact, while I was in Congress, I played a major role in helping to defeat Bush's faith-based initiative. Which, by the way, without going too far off the topic, is not what it sounds like. Basically, it's government-funded discrimination, because we already do help religious organizations. That's off topic. If you want to ask me about it later, you can. But the point is, I strongly believe in separation of church and state. And yet, in order to talk to the people from Kansas, I had to speak their language. You know, if you go to France and you speak English, they're not going to listen to you too much. If you go to Kansas and you don't speak Bible, they're not going to hear you. So let me tell you what I've been talking a lot about, this nice Jewish boy. I've been talking about the New Testament. I've been talking about Jesus. I've probably talked more about Jesus in my 2 years on radio than all my life beforehand. And here's what I tell my listeners. Show me in the New Testament where Jesus condemned homosexuality. Show me in the New Testament where Jesus condemned abortion. And even if you can find something that's tenuously there, I will show 100 times where Jesus says, care about the poor. And you tell me what Jesus cared most about. And where is the Christian coalition as people are losing health care? They're out helping Terry Schiavo as 18,000 Americans die every year from inadequate health care. And I don't say to them, what's the liberal, what's the moral thing to do? This nice Jewish boy says, what's the Christian thing to do? I try to speak their language. Read the Bible. There's a lot of very interesting concepts in there. I'm not saying take it literally. I certainly don't. But do you know that in the Old Testament, there was a Jubilee year where every 50 years, they redistributed the land so that everyone would start off equal again? And I hope you do. I would love to see a combination Boulder, Colorado Springs World Conference. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great? The events down there, and then we'd have real debate, right? Next time you're talking to someone, you know, about the capital gains tax cut that they like so much, ask them about the Jubilee year. Most of them have read their Bibles, more than maybe some of us have, full opportunity, and watch their mouths drop. You want to do something really cool? Check out the verse and give them chapter and verse. They really like that. And I hope I'm really not trying to sound condescending. I hope I'm not, because I really do respect their beliefs, including the ones I disagree with. Because there's a lot of beauty in the Bible. There really is. We can reinforce our principles. And the last thing I want to talk about is faith. And I don't think that's a contradiction. One of the things that I have found really interesting, right? People want to stereotype something. And now, yes, gay people are the biggest ones on the chopping block. And what I found is, when you bring it home to people, oh, so you have a gay child, you're going to send them out into the wilderness? Why are you insisting that this couple in San Francisco be unhappy? What's it to you? What if they don't want you to be happy? Should they, you know? I, if you talk about marriage, I always bring up Anna Nicole Smith. Because that marriage offends me. I think it's a threat to the institution of marriage. But I wouldn't forcibly divorce them. What's interesting to me is that a lot of people, and I talk with these listeners all the time, they want the status of victim. They've learned perhaps from the civil rights movement, perhaps from the achievements that blacks have made, that women have made, that gay people are starting to make, that when you are victimized and you call people on it, sometimes you can do better. So they will tell you, and they believe this, that Christians in America are victimized. They will tell you that the Boy Scouts are being victimized. That the military is being victimized. The Boy Scouts is a great issue. The Boy Scouts is being victimized, but because of their anti-gay prejudice, some states don't want to support them. They are being victimized because they are bigots. How dare we victimize bigots? I'm of the belief we should victimize bigots. Let them speak, but don't give them any money. I have no problem victimizing bigots. So I guess I just want to say, when talking about bigotry, speak to the Bible again. Remember, Jesus hung out with prostitutes. He hung out with lepers. And he says it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven. And then ask yourself, which party Jesus would support, what would Jesus do? Thank you.
We'll take a minute for the panelists to respond to each other, but keep it brief so the audience can speak to us.
I just want to urge people to be a little cautious with this Bible stuff, because fundamentalists who claim to read the Bible word for word, the only thing they acknowledge as metaphor is with the rich man camel thing. That's metaphor, they'll tell you. The rest of it's all literally true. And it is a fact, you know, there is a profound conflict between the teachings of the Colorado Springs Fraser Crane for Brown Shirts, Dr. Dobson, and the book of Matthew, in which Jesus talks about the poor. The Sermon on the Mount is there. When Satan tempted Jesus, guess what the last temptation was? Dominion over all the earth. Guess what these folks want? It is something that I think John might elaborate on. It's a combination of how your brain is hardwired. I got a feeling that there are people who are born punitive and censorious, and they join the political party that plays it out, and they make the kind of religious choices that play it out. I have an emotional context which we can support intellectually and morally.
Thank you. Anybody else?
I would agree.
Questions from the audience? Any comments? Any shy people?
Against their own interests. I do it all the time as a far left progressive voting for the environment that doesn't really affect me. I only really heard Mark address that. Well, I think that can be a really good thing, but I might have misunderstood some of the others. But it seems like the real critical issue is not voting against our issues, but it's the extremism of taking one isolated issue and ignoring all others. I'm wondering if any of you would like to speak to that.
I started my remarks by trying to make the distinction between voting against your own issues in the spirit of compromise, with the sense that you are caring about a bigger community and you're willing to make those trade-offs, and we do them in families and we do them in communities. And I totally agree with you. It's the right thing to do. It's the proper thing to do. It acknowledges that people have different needs at different times than you do, and that there's costs, both moral and financial, to your community if those needs aren't met. Healthcare, of course, is one of them. We do them in families. We sacrifice so that our kids can have things, and we do them in our communities. So I think that's absolutely important. Now, in terms of how to make that a national initiative, I'm 100% sure how to do it, because it is about the emotional issues where someone focuses on just one thing. And that's the other part of what we've all been talking about. I am energized and kind of titillated about the idea. I'm going to dial that back for his really moving remarks about his own journey to understand who he is. And I was excited about the idea of other politicians joining in some sort of therapeutic process, so that which I think is almost going to be incredibly difficult. I would add up to a whole component of quasi-religious people in this country, the Christians that only go to church on Easter and Christmas, who pray only when they need something, which is a lot of people. There's a lot of people in my family who are deeply, deeply defensive for issues of class. And that schism between the haves and the have-nots has been here since the country was founded, from the noblemen and the landed gentry and the peasants who worked that land. I mean, that has not abated. And until we begin to look at why someone who is defensive about having dirt under their fingernails and keys dangling from their belt and struggling to put food on the table would be moved by a party that is almost invariably educated at elite universities but just, you know, pretends to mispronounce the word nuclear, to make a connection with them on that human level. Like, I know what it means to have dirt on your fingernails. I know what it means to be a regular guy. I know how hard it is, and all these fancy schmancy people run on everything. They don't understand who we are. That's just simply not true. That's another way, in addition to the evangelical component, that people get manipulated. It certainly was true in my family.
Yeah, and Todd Frank's examples in the book are a little more direct than what you were talking about. I mean, I'm familiar with that. I vote against my own best interest when we're talking about income tax increases, when we're talking about that sort of thing. His examples are people who will vote a straight Republican Party line because of a position on abortion, when in the meantime they're losing their job, which is the only job in the county, at the slaughterhouse, because of Republican Party policies, and they don't make the connection.
Let me, because I did speak, but I made this clear. it will sound contrary to yours, but four lines. One is, the vision by which I lead my life is one that was spoken by Carl Rogers, who wrote that book. I'm becoming a person I didn't write, he wrote it, but spoken, we did a workshop. He said that, if I've been doing psychology for 60 years, I come to believe that human beings are innately inclined toward becoming life-affirming, constructive, responsible, and trustworthy. I believe that about each of us. I've come to know that. I've gone deeper in myself. It's more likely true than I used to believe, contrary. That's my belief. Secondly, it's also true, it's nature and nurture, or nature versus nurture, that I've come to figure out that if I had had your experiences in your life, I would probably think and act just like you do now. Mm-hmm. And that's true of the people in Kansas and the people too. So if I know that, that's not to excuse it, but it's to understand it and then try to deal with him or her in ways, deal is the wrong word, engage in ways that are respectful and yet evocative. Safe-making is a good way. Thirdly, I believe we always each act in our own self-interest. Depends on how deep enlightened we are. I mean, I have a good income. I vote to raise taxes whenever I get a chance. It's not against my self-interest. I have more than enough money. So it's not... I think we act... how do we enlighten people's self-interest? And fourth, one issue. My hunch is, and this may sound... I don't mean to sound condescending, but my hunch is... Because I was... You know, I was the totally disembodied, guilt-ridden Catholic kid. I wouldn't go into a Protestant church for a minute for fear of going to hell forever. The only team was Notre Dame. I was caught being a Catholic because I had nothing else to be caught up with inside myself. Now that I'm in myself in a way that's healthy, what religion you brought, I don't care. So no single issue would cause me to decide how to perform a major decision. So I think it's important. I think identity leads to the politics, to the self-interest enlightenment, and as well to the amount to which we cling to security or cling to identity outside of ourselves.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to address this to all of you, especially Mark, though. My name's Mark as well.
Speak up.
Can you hear me? I'm from Colorado Springs.
Okay. I haven't even attacked
Colorado Springs. I know. I'm hoping. Is anybody else here? All right. Okay, there are a few here. But...
I don't know why. Here we go, closer.
The issue, though, is not, well, you know, Massachusetts, Kansas, Colorado Springs, Boulder. The issue is, I think, we're preaching to the choir most of the time, as you say. And I call out, to, you know, John and Mark, especially for taking the chance to get your faith. Talking to Jim Palmer here a while ago about the very thing you suggested, having some of this, maybe a conference or panel down in Colorado Springs, and because dialogue is what needs to happen.
There's nothing I would like more than to speak in Colorado Springs. I would like more. In fact, I'll tell you something. When I do my radio show, I do different kinds of days. Every Tuesday, I do something called Debate Tuesday, where I specifically invite on air someone who completely disagrees with me.
Well, it wouldn't be me, because I agree, and that's why I'm up here.
But
on the other hand, I can find you some.
No, I'd like that, because I'll tell you something. A lot of times, they don't want to debate me.
Right.
I've invited James Dobson and his organization on my show time and time again. Yeah. And I debated them once on the issue of same-sex marriage, and they've never debated me again. And I think that... Listen, I believe in what I say strongly enough. I think we can win on the plane of ideas.
Well, and here's my suggestion. Rather than go right to the heart of the issue, it's like you have an issue with your wife, your husband, you don't get right there. You have to dance around a little bit. Instead of go to gay rights or whatever, I'm thinking, for instance, I've had my eyes open. I've had situations where I'm talking, we have a project called Earth Seeds where we work with the Air Force Academy and people with pictures of the planet. I used to be a park ranger. Well, part of the reason I left there was preaching to the choir. But to go to them, and we have a thing, part of this getting the picture of the earth in every church. Well, most of my liberal friends think, oh, you know, why bother talking to those guys? They're, you know, doomsday thing, and when the last tree's cut, we all go up in heaven and all this. Well, I had a dialogue with a guy who was a creationist, and it was very interesting. He opened my eyes and says, you know, for me, so I was amazed that he got that in my church. I want to put that in on both sides. I had, you know, I was in the United States Naval Academy, and I got crapped on for having a uniform. This was back in the day, and then got out to Santa Barbara, had long hair, get crapped on for that. We're all just people. So my question is, if you would be willing, all of you, with that area. I know Mark's saying yes, but...
Mark, are you inviting us over?
Yes. I am.
Well, can I just
college,
say...
College, yeah.
If I've done anything to give anybody here the impression I only hang out with people who are just like me, I truly apologize. I mean, And in fact, you are far, chances are you're far more liberal than I will ever be. Part of my job, as part of my life, I talk to, eat dinner with, regular, and I'll, you know, snacks provided, I'll come over for free, but I'd love to talk to anybody about anything.
Great. Yeah. Well, I think that's just a great moral model. All of us need to do that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with that. And I also think this whole left-right continuum thing is bullshit. I don't think any of us fit into it. I think it's just very useful for the right.
Well, great, because I think the new term is neither left nor right, but forward, like John was saying.
Yeah. Thanks. I voted for Bob Dole.
Can we get to the next?
Just alienate further. Thank you, Mark.
Hi, my housemate is Italian, and he explained to me that in Italy, things like abortion or same-sex marriage, et cetera, not that I want to emulate Italian politics, but that they tend to be referendums that people will vote on. And I'm just curious if having such a thing might help eliminate. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, it's very interesting, but it took forever for Italy to legalize divorce even. So I think in a lot of instances a representative legislature is probably more progressive than the people at large once they're exposed to the kind of advertising campaigns we've seen in California on initiatives. I don't think that's a solution. I think it's an interesting idea, but I don't think it would change anything.
I'm really against putting it to a vote, and because I believe in the Constitution. The reason why we have certain issues that are beyond the majority is basic human rights. I'm angry about that because ban marriages between blacks and whites of Americans. Supported laws banning interracial marriages. In 1954, when the Supreme Court did Brown versus Board of Education, there's no question that at least in the 13 states, including Kansas, and a lot of southern states, the majority of the people had segregated schools. So some issues, when it comes to fundamental human rights, one of the things I'm so proud of in this Constitution is that we don't put that up to a vote. Now, tax cuts, Social Security, things I care a lot about, definitely should be decided by the majority. But fundamental human rights, it may dissolve the issue, but it's too important. Prayer in schools, another example. 75% of Americans support prayer in public schools. The Constitution, at least the way I read it, says you can't do that. So not with fundamental human rights, and I wouldn't put it to a vote. Thank you.
It's interesting. I thought of that right after I spoke.
It's a good question, though.
My other question to you was, is there any option of, I don't know, people, I really believe that if people allotted, I want this percentage of my taxes to go to this. This is what's most important to me. If people actually allotted their tax dollars to education, what feasibility is there of that? Because I feel like those ultra-conservative Republicans who vote just on abortion, many of them still really do value education. And how would that change?
Well, we'd have a massive amount of money dedicated to not doing abortions. I mean, that doesn't seem like a great use because the money. Well, wait, maybe it would. You know, maybe it would balance the budget if all those people devoted their tax money to not having abortions and we put it in a fund.
I don't think that was enough.
Thank you. Do you have a question?
I have to stop the broadcast here, at least for our radio listeners, and thank you for listening in. Tune in Monday. There's no show on Sunday, but tune in Monday. We're going to talk about the nomination of John Bolton, and I want to thank you, radio listeners, very much. If you're listening on the Internet at RadioInsideScoop.com, stay tuned. Welcome back. Recently, I've been doing a number of internet extensions, and maybe I need more time on the radio. I only have an hour, but you folks who listen in at RadioInsideScoop.com, sometimes you get a little bit more. The questioning continues at the panel. What's the matter with Kansas? Why people vote against their interests? I'm going to go right back to the next question.
I think one of you might have touched on this as of the self-interest of people who are voting on the abortion issue only, and everything else is against their self-interest. But I have a sister who's a born-again Christian, and what she told me was, even though she might go for some of the things that the Democrats like, she could not look her God in the face if she voted for a pro-abortion candidate. Therefore, that is a self-interest of hers. And it's another way of looking at it. They're not voting against their self-interest on the spiritual plane. They're putting that above the material plane.
I think it's one reason why we need pro-life Democrats. And I'm, again, as pro-choice as you can be. But and by the way, there are pro-choice single-issue voters, too. There are people who like the Republican position on foreign policy and taxes, but they're pro-choice. So they're going to vote for the pro-choice candidate. So, in fact, I actually think they probably balance each other out. Pretty much the single issue voters, but yeah, that's her position, and I respect that. And I got to tell you, abortion is one of those few issues very hard to convince someone on.
And the answer to that is for other churches to get involved. I don't think, you know, I think if that's your sister's sincere belief, I don't think it's going to change, and I don't think her church's belief is going to change. But there are other churches with deep beliefs about equality and that sort of thing. I mean, the church I've belong to has now been read out of the international church because we got a gay bishop. You know, well, big deal. We're right, they're wrong, so what?
Thank you.
I'm very curious. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the most optimistic, how does each of you feel in terms of your approach to any sort of slowing down or reversing any of the policies of the Bush administration, both foreign with Iraq and